the mountain, and now we sleep for a thousand years. I will see you again. Something is coming, coming for me.
Listener supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And Cheryl Costa was a guest on this show back in 2014, but there's been so much exciting news concerning UFOs lately that I thought it advantageous to invite her back. Cheryl Costa is a native and resident of upstate New York, and who saw her first UFO at age 12. She's a military veteran and a retired information security professional from aerospace industry. She's been a speaker at the International UFO Congress and at the MUFON Symposium. Cheryl writes the UFO column New York Skies for the Syracuse Times.com. Besides her journalism, she also is a published playwright. She holds a bachelor's of arts degree from the State University of New York at Empire State College in entertainment writing. So, let's welcome back Cheryl Costa. Hello, Cheryl.
Hi, Dave. How you doing?
I'm doing well. And yourself?
Oh, terrific.
I understand it's snowing over there in New York.
As they say, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. I got no place to go, but I'm just sitting here in my pajamas watching it snow.
Well, you shouldn't tell the listeners. They just, I'm all dolled up, you know? And ready to go.
No, the reality is I'm running around in a flannel house dress trying to stay warm. That's the deal.
It's like that, what is it, the commercial where the guy's on Skype, he's got a suit and tie on, and when he's done, he gets up, he's in his underwear or something, you know?
Yeah.
No pants. Yeah. Anyway, we're getting off track here. Refresh our listeners' memory as to your personal sighting as a child, would you?
Well, that was, about 65, I think it was August of 65. Mm-hmm. We were visiting relatives late August afternoon. We were about 3 weeks before school started again, you know. Mm-hmm. And we were coming down off the hill around 4 o'clock, 4:30. And it was a really wet year that year, so all the corn was well over, taller than the car, okay? Wow. And we were coming down this dirt road from the farm up at my uncle's, and off in the western sky, and you got to understand, it was a clear blue sky, not a cloud in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother suddenly had my father stop the car and pull off the road. And I said, what's wrong? You know, I thought something was wrong with the car. And she pointed out into the western sky, and there was this bright ball out there, shiny ball. And to give you a perspective, if you hold your arm out and look at your little fingernail, that's how big it was. Okay? And it just it was parked there like a rock. And so my mom explained, you know, NASA was only 5 or 6 years old at that point. So she said it might be something NASA was doing, might be something the Air Force doing, could be a weather balloon, you know, might be people from another world.
Is that what she told you?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, my brother and sisters were toddlers, so, like, this was like, you know, they weren't even paying attention. We talked about it, and then my father got the car back on the road, and we drove down to the bottom of the hill. As we turned left to get back on the state road, we had a big old Chevy Impala. I crawled up in that big back window, that thing, and I sat there looking at that thing and just saying, you know, who are you guys? Who are you guys? You know? And I must have watched it for 15 minutes as we went down the highway. It was the interstate at that point. And all of a sudden, it decided to leave. It was one of those things like you see in the modern Starship movies. Gone.
Wow.
You know, and it just shot off like a shot, and just from a standing still position to, you know, everything in a moment, you know. Mm. And, like, that changed me. So after that, my mom and I started both getting books at the library, and I'd read one, she'd read one. We kind of gave each other, like, little book reports, that kind of thing, you know.
Wow.
And, you know, I was sixth grade or so, and we would share with them what we had. And, of course, we had little 3x5 cards of sticking in for special chapters and everything. Mm-hmm. When Von Daniken's book came out a couple of years later,
mm-hmm.
The copy we had in the house was a paperback, and Mom dog-eared on the top pages. I dog-eared on the bottom pages. The book was destroyed, honestly. It was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But it kept us both very interested in the topic. I'll give you another example.
When you say Von Daniken, that was Chariots of the Gods?
Chariots of the Gods,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And so I was in high school when that was floating around.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I remember my mom getting she had subscribed to some things, you know, and I remember her getting a mimeographed letter from someplace in Ohio. These people were studying some group called the Mutual UFO Network. Okay, and I think she ended up sending a few bucks in and getting on the, it was a little mimeograph newsletter kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that was pretty much it. And I graduated from high school in 70, so, and then I was in the military. I joined the military, joined the Air Force right out of high school. So my next event was about a year after I graduated in 71, Christmas Eve, it was about 11:30 at night in Cameron Bay, Vietnam. Clear, clear night sky, and I'm walking down to the base chapel to go to midnight mass for something to do. I wasn't even really Catholic anymore, but it was something to do. And a friend of mine in the barracks, we were walking there, and we saw this streak going across the sky. We thought, ah, it's a jet, you know, and then it stopped. And we sat there and looked at it, and my friend was saying, what, jets don't do that, and helicopters don't fly that fast, you know. I said, yeah, and if that's what I think it is, it's going to start dancing around like a fairy, darn if it didn't, and then, gone, you know. And like I said, we got the midnight mass, neither one of our minds around our midnight mass, we just, you know. It was mind-boggling. I didn't tell anybody that story until about 15 years ago. I was like everybody else. Oh, you don't tell anybody about these sightings. They'll think you're crazy.
Yeah. Well, now, some people heading off for church, seeing something like that, would say, that was an angel. That was God himself saying, go to church.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, some might.
Yeah. But you didn't think so, right?
No, I had walked away from the Catholic tradition when I was 17.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I was born in Clare. I don't often say this on UFO shows, but I was born in a family, a clairvoyant family.
Okay,
And my relatives who have the gift and myself tend to see the world a little differently than most people.
Right, right.
And so by the time I got to 17 years old, I couldn't deal with the rhetoric I was hearing in the Catholic Church. I don't want to get into that, but the bottom line, at that time, a lot of people were getting, it was like the birth control debate and all this stuff, people were getting up, and when the sermon would get off on the birth control or something like that, half the congregation would get up and stomp out, you know, that kind of thing. And so, you know, it was a very turmoil period in the church, and I couldn't deal with it anymore, and I just left. And I floated around a few years. In fact, when I got in the Air Force in the barracks, I went to services with everybody that were my, like, you know, people who lived in my barracks. I went to everything you could shake a stick at. Went to more tent revivals. Went to more river baptisms you can shake a stick at. You know. And when I got over to Vietnam, I had a whole bunch of Native American friends. You know. And that got me looking more towards the shamanic cultures, okay? And that's kind of where my heart's been ever since. But that, we're off topic here at this point. Unless you want to talk about UFOs and consciousness, then
oh,
that's
listen. My show has been going that route. In fact, my next show, I plan, I'm not going to give this away, but I plan on getting into other dimensional ghosts and spirit communication and how that connects with the UFO phenomenon, or does it connect with the UFO phenomenon?
Our community, our paranormal community, tends to put all these topic matters in stovepipes, you know.
Right.
But there, if you're close to it, like I am, and a number of people I know are, and if you talk to Ray Hernandez at the Free Foundation, he'll tell you this: it's all the same phenomena, different aspects of the same phenomena.
You must be psychic, because Ray Hernandez happens to be the guest to which I was referring. What? Out of all the researchers, I said, well, I'm going to have a guy on. Oh, Ray Hernandez. Yeah. I don't like...
I'll tell you a little story. I was at the Arkansas UFO conference.
Right.
Back in April,
okay,
and Ray was there to speak as well.
All right,
and a couple of times, part of the contract with that conference is you're supposed to schmooze with people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know, a lot of these conferences, the speakers all they go do their talk and they go hide. You know,
yeah, right.
And so Ray and I a couple of times were out having a cup of coffee, maybe got a piece of pie from the little canteen they had set up in the lobby of the conference center. And a couple of times we got in some really, really spirited conversations, and we ended up having our own little audience around. People would start pulling up chairs, and next thing you know, you look around, you got 30 or 40 people sitting around listening to this very spirited conversation, you know.
Uh-huh.
And the two of us were sitting there spouting all this stuff, and what we didn't realize is all these people are listening to us talk about the secrets of the universe, you know, so... It was a very intriguing experience. I picked up an awful lot of Facebook friends after that conference.
Well, I'll bet you. You say spirited conversation. Were you in disagreement or in agreement with each other?
Oh, we were, but we're from different directions.
Okay.
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 And one would literally stimulate something in the other person. It was going back and forth like this, and we were just each other in the course of this debate and conversation, it turned into one person being the muse for the other, and it was just absolutely an amazing hour and a half or 2 hours the two of us were sitting here rattling at each other. And every now and then somebody would tap you on the shoulder and say, could you explain what that word means? We'd both stop, we'd look at him, we'd explain what it was and go back to what we were talking about, you know.
Yeah.
It was an interesting experience. And I think the world of Ray, I really do.
Yeah. Well, I hate to say on one show what the next one's going, what I plan on the next one being. What if it falls through, you know? But I do plan on having Ray on the show, and if everything goes well, we're gonna speak to him next time. But let's get off on that subject. What do you think about the connection between the spiritual plane, the spiritual realm, and UFOs?
Okay.
You say that like, okay, now let me get my bearings here because I'm going to...
No. Hey, I just did my own radio program a half an hour ago,
okay. And
that program deals purely with mysticism, so I'm already in a frame of mind.
Let's do it.
Let me give your audience a real quick viewpoint,
mm-hmm.
And let's use Star Wars theology,
mm-hmm.
Okay, the Force, okay?
Okay.
So if you take away all the faces of the gods and goddesses out there, and if you talk to my Hindu friends, they'll tell you there's 33 million gods,
mm-hmm.
and goddesses, okay? Okay, what you ultimately are left with is the pure life force or the force of the universe. It is the great consciousness. It is unknowable. It's unconceivable. And it is if you look at every rock, you look at the books on your shelf, you look at the lamp across the room, you look at the carpet, you look at the bugs on the window out there, all of it is made up of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason these things all look different, the books, the bugs on the wall, all that stuff, the fish in my aquarium, that's simply their form. Now, if I had you here in the room and I was looking across the table at you and you were looking back across the table at me, all we have is two instances of the great consciousness staring at itself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Gotcha.
So we are all the great consciousness. We are all made up of the Force.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, the problem we have in our culture, in our species, we have this element. And I'm going to use a little piece of Christian theology for you for a moment, okay? As a mystic, we tend to look at something called the younger self, the higher self, and the talking self, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's put that in Christian theology. God the Father is the ultimate force. The Holy Spirit is that younger self, that's that spark of the instant, that instance of the great consciousness that's within each of us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're not separate. We think we are, and that's the talking self. That's the part that's talking to you right now, who tries to rationalize everything and conceptualize everything. And we are not separate from the God force out there. We are walking in it. The God force as Obi-Wan Kenobi says, permeates and binds the universes or the multiverse together.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's that immense.
So, in other words, all is one.
All is one.
Yeah.
Everywhere, every when, everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, what E.T. seems to be interested in, they don't want to talk to us with radios. They don't want to talk to us with lasers and technology. They are waiting for us to stop being distracted by what our talking selves are dealing with. And these days, back you know, a couple thousand years ago, you know, most villages, it was, you know, they were a lot closer to the earth and nature and all that kind of thing, primitive tribes, as we might call them.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, they had an edge over us because they were very connected to nature and the force and all that sort of thing. These days when we're distracted, and ever since cell phones came out, you know, everybody's just walking around with this thing in their hand with all these channels of social media and distraction and videos and radio and all this stuff. And the problem is, and this is something I teach my students, you're not going to become a Jedi Knight, you're not going to become a mystic with a cell phone in your hand.
No.
Okay,
no.
You have, and this is coming from my years of living in a Buddhist monastery, which I did. I lived 7 years in a Tibetan Buddhist monastery, and what we are dealing with, the talking self, the part of me that's talking to you, I have all this chatter going on in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we all have this chatter, and some people have more chatter than others. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And it's that chatter that has to be quieted down, so that you can hear, as we mystics call it, the song of the universe. Okay.
And how do you achieve that? Meditation or
meditation? Some shamanic traditions, it's done with psychotropic substances and things like this. But it can be attained with just simple quieting and meditation. Now, it's not, you don't learn to meditate in one evening. You might learn the basic technique in one evening, but it takes time. It took me several years to get it to the point where my adeptness with it was sufficient for this There's a term they use with the Aborigines. The Aboriginal tribes are in this like fifth dimensional consciousness mode kind of thing.
Okay.
And they're aware of the mountains singing to each other. They're aware of the trees singing to each other. And when you start getting to this frame of mindset and quietness, you become aware of a much, much bigger reality around you.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the Native Americans' mindset, right?
Yeah, they're very close to it as well, yes. Yeah. At least the traditionals, you know.
Right.
That's exactly the point. It's about quieting. And a lot of ritual, people wonder about what all the dancing and drumming and rituals are. These are tools we use to distract and numb the conscious mind down to a point where you're open to this.
Mm.
You don't talk to the younger self. You don't talk to that little subconscious aspect that's connected to everything, everywhere, everyone. You don't talk to it with words. It's talked to with symbols and music and play acting and nonverbal communication.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
So, in form of ET. ET seems to be interested in, they're interested in a couple of things. They're interested in the fact that we're wrecking our planet.
Right.
They're very concerned about that. And then they're also, where they are, what they are waiting for with us is they're waiting for enough of us to become quiet enough and connected enough that it's not about them contacting us, it's about us waking up enough to say, oh, you were there all along.
Do you think that point's coming real soon, or do you think enough people are realizing we know they're there?
Well, they're, look at Paul Harris's conferences down in Las Vegas, Laughlin.
Right.
Her conferences really focus on the consciousness aspect of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and a number of the other. In fact, I'm booked to speak at Contact in the Desert this spring.
Okay.
And I do two talks. I do a workshop, and I'm doing a talk. Well, my talk is UFO statistics. My workshop is of a mystical consciousness nature,
mm-hmm.
with hands-on. Okay? And so that's the flavor. I'm going to show people. Most people have never touched something. Give me an example. If I give you a strawberry, and you taste it, you've never tasted one before, and you bite into it and say, so that's what a strawberry tastes like, right? All right. Most people have never had a measurable mystical event. Okay, we've had dreams and things like that, but most people have not had a measurable mystical event.
All right.
And the deal with this is, in fact, one of the things I learned in the monastery is once you've had one, then you know what the next one, the rest of them are going to taste like.
Okay.
And what they feel like.
Okay.
Okay. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to teach them a very quick crash course in sort of like remote viewing, and I'm going to demonstrate to them that they can know something without experiencing it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, which is what remote viewing is. You're pulling from the great non-local bank of now all the knowledge in the universe that's contained within the Force. And that's what remote viewers tapped into originally. And that, if you teach the technique, that's what you can show people, is they can touch something outside of themselves without words.
Right. Here's a question for you. There are so many. Let me do this first, and then I will get back with this. Remind me, I've got a question for you as to remote viewing. Okay. I need to take a moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to We Are Not Alone. This is WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with researcher and journalist Cheryl Costa. Now, if my brain has not shut down, I have a question for you. That's all it takes, you know. You go upstairs to get something, and why am I here, you know? At any rate, Yeah, as to remote viewing and that type of thing. There are so many magicians that can do that so convincingly, but it's an illusion, it's a trick. And how do you tell the tricksters from the real thing?
Well, okay. In fact, usually when I get a class, I taught five classes of this stuff over the past 20 years. And I'm not saying it was like a one-night class. These were like about a 6 to 8 month commitment, once a month for a whole Sunday afternoon kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, taught basic theory. We would do a refresher each month of our basic theory. I would add another element to the process. But then I had people who were, my spouse did this for me. She had interns stuff envelopes with targets for us.
Okay.
Might be a picture, it might be a 3x5 card with some information on it, it might be a latitude, longitude, you know, any number of things that was a very definable target,
mm-hmm.
someplace and perhaps someplace else in time, okay?
Hmm.
And the interns would stuff these envelopes. We'd have like 50 or 100 of them stuffed for us by this separate team, okay, of people that I didn't know.
Okay.
And then another intern would take all these envelopes, sit down on a computer with a random number generator, and write random numbers on an 8 to 10 digit random number on each one using a random number generator on the computer.
Right.
And then they threw them all in a big basket for me. And that was it. And when I got them, it was essentially double blind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you got that. So you train people with the basic technique. And so the deal is, we get into remote viewing protocols, it's essentially once we get you cooled down with some breathing meditation, or if we're doing it high tech, we put a set of headphones on you and we pump hemisync into your ear, neurosync hemisync into your ears. And basically what that is you've got white noise going in your ears, but in one earphone you're getting a 100 hertz tone submerged in the white noise. In the other earphone, you're getting 108 hertz tone. And what happens is each hemisphere of the brain is resonating with the tone, and between the hemispheres of your brain is an 8 hertz beat, and that puts you into alpha in about 5 to 10 minutes.
Hmm.
Okay? It's a mechanical process, but boy, it works really well.
You can get that tone, you can get those tones off of YouTube, can't you? You ever tried that?
I'm told they hear. I don't trust those because I don't know who made them.
Okay.
And when I do it, I use it only from. There's different groups that make these hemisync CDs, and I tend to use the ones that are recommended by people because I don't know if somebody's submerging something in there that shouldn't be.
Right. You got it. Okay. Go ahead.
So. So we give them a few minutes to cool down with that, and then I take them through a set of protocols, and I'll read off the number to them, this 8 to 10 digit number, three times with a command tone in my voice, and then I direct them to draw an ideogram, and it's usually just a simple squiggle. It's nothing really artistic. It's like a little squiggle, kind of looks like a hieroglyphic to some degree, or almost like a Chinese character. And from that point, as we walk through the protocols and we do a data mining, talking to the person, they touch their pencil against that ideogram to get another connection back to the subconscious and to what the target is. And at each stage of each protocol, we're getting more and more detail. Sometimes we're getting a thing called an anomalous. A thing called an AOL, and sometimes you see somebody scribbling something in the margin or drawing something in the margin. When they're done doing it, they throw the pencil down, they pick it up, and then they go back to the protocols and are actually writing out what the terrain is, what the flavor is, what the temperature is, what the color is, all that kind of thing. And there's a very, very specific set of protocols that go in layers.
Mm-hmm.
And then after you do it, my session can go as little as 20 minutes for a very simple target. I can go up to, I've had them go as much as 90 minutes. And then you sit down with everybody and then show them what you got, and they each open up their envelope with all their 3 or 4 pages of notes, and they lay them out there. And now you start looking at their pages, and you start seeing some people have drawn it in the margins, the data's there for it. Sometimes you get people, I was in one class with a bunch of artists, and I was a student in the class. We had somebody from the Farsight Institute come and teach. And we happened to have a class of people who were musicians and artists.
Mm-hmm.
And he was there for a 4-day weekend training session, the instructor was. And when he realized we were all artists of some sort, he had us at the end of the first day where he expected to have all of us on the 3rd or 4th day of the thing. So we got a lot of advanced training because artists and musicians tend to resonate to this stuff very easily. It's part of the right brain functionality.
Right, right.
And so we did that. And so you go through and you look at everybody. There's no charlatans. In fact, the people who come in pounding on their chest, oh, I'm a professional psychic, 9 times out of 10, they can't do this. You know why they can't do it? Because they won't let go, because they've got it in their left brain that they've got to go, that we've got to do it this way, you know? Mm-hmm. And they can't do it because they won't relax and just follow the process.
Right. Hmm.
Okay, so what ends up happening at the end of the session is we do a reveal, we tack up the whatever the target was. Sometimes it's a 3x5 card. I'll give you an example. Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walking on the moon planting the flag.
Okay.
And you always have a if you're smart, you always have a temporal reference on there, and you say July 20th, 1969, or something like that. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And time, you can actually get down to the hour and minute, you can, if you like. But the bottom line is, or it might be a picture, you know, it might be a photograph of the Eiffel Tower or something, or Notre Dame Cathedral, or Mickey Mouse, Marilyn Monroe having her dress blown up in that iconic picture. You
right,
know?
Right.
It could be something like that. And you put it up there and pack it up on the whiteboard, and then it's kind of like a detective thing. People start telling you what material, what they have, and you've got their material passed. Now, one class we did it on the telephone. I would set up a conference call. It'd be an evening. It was an evening class. We did it every week, actually, this particular class. The group was called Silver Sight. And I had people in 6 different zip codes, okay, in 2 different time zones. Okay.
Okay.
And so I talked. I would talk to them. I cooled them out down on the phone, and then we would go ahead and do the session. And I would talk them through the target references, and then I would go ahead and talk them through the protocols, and take it very slowly through the whole thing. And then what I had them do was scan and fax the material for me before I would do a reveal on what the target was.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that way there was nobody sitting here looking at what the target was and then drawing it in on their form.
Right, right.
So this is how you get away from the charlatans and things.
Hmm.
And it was amazing the material that we generated and some of the stuff that we identified. There were some standard cards. I had the people who stuffed the cards, the envelopes for my spouse. There were about a dozen standard cards that I made sure got into the mix every time.
Okay.
And one of them was, the answers always came back when we got done. People would put their pens down. I'd say, okay, that's the end of session, and they would log, like, and the time is, da-da-da-da, and they'd write it on their paper, and then they put their pen down. And part of the psyche of when you put your pen down, that is a cue that you're breaking the session. You're stopping the session.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever this card got put down, usually the response from 2 or 3 of the people would be, whoever those people were, they didn't like us being there.
Hmm.
And that was a very common response with all 5 classes that I taught over 20 years. Okay? And the card was, we sent them to the alien base on the backside of the moon.
Okay. Okay. I was just going to say, it was the moon, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the one on the backside of the moon.
Right.
And it's funny because I was wrapping up one of my classes, and I said, where have we been? And, I mean, in fact, this class ran once a month for a year. And there was 12, we started out with 15. We ended up settling out at about 11 or 12 people. Some people dropped out because they couldn't do it, or they didn't like it, or they thought it was boring or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I would do a review of the class and some of the targets we did. And I said, you have been to the bottom of the ocean and have seen Titanic where it is now.
Mm-hmm.
You have been with Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on the moon. You've watched them plant the flag. You've watched, you were with Harrison Schmitt when he was finding that four billion-year-old rock and they're driving around on the moon in the rover in December of 72.
Okay.
You have been walked on the beach that Amelia Earhart took her last breath on. Mm. Okay. These were the kinds of targets we sent them to.
Right.
And yes, we did some experimental targets. We sent them, tried to send them to the White House. And the three classes that had the White House card, each got, they got the pen down. They looked at us and said, that place is warded. We couldn't go there. They didn't, it's, we had, there was like a warning sign, don't come here.
Really?
Okay? Yeah. And there's a two.
Well, now, why couldn't they?
Classified bases. They were warded. They were protected. They weren't. We weren't allowed to be there.
We weren't allowed to be there. Well, what difference does it make if you're doing remote viewing? Do they respect that in their mind?
Apparently, again, this is the mystical side of me. Somebody put up a barrier and said no.
Really?
Yeah. And two of them were very sensitive bases, and we just our people, you know, couldn't go there. Okay. And,
so have you ever had anybody go remote viewing to Dulce?
Yep.
And did you get in?
Nope.
Good gracious.
That's telling in itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And yet it's mind-boggling that you can't go anywhere you want. It's like going somewhere in spirit.
Well, yeah, but all you're really doing, you're not, and people, and for the audience that thinks, oh, they're doing astral projection. No. Astral projection is the perception that you're leaving your body. You leave your body, you die.
Okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Astral projection, if you think you're leaving your body, it's a consciousness thing. You're shifting your consciousness in time and space.
Okay.
That's what this is. And I've got this from the lamas because I was demonstrating remote viewing. Oh, yeah, we've been doing that for years. Our monks would sit in Chinese prisons and go anywhere they want, you know,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing, okay? And so it's a matter of shifting consciousness.
Okay.
We don't understand the shielding side of it. I really don't understand it myself other than somebody very powerful who understands mechanics basically warded the place. The White House is very clearly very clearly warded.
Mm.
Okay, but so the cool thing with remote viewing is two things you have to keep in mind when you define a target. One of the things they discovered, the Army people discovered this, and we certainly discovered this, that you have to have temporal references. Okay, I'll give you an example. One of the remote viewers once upon a time was being tested by one of the intel agencies, right? And they sent him to some lat longitude was the target.
Mm-hmm.
Turned out to be some Soviet base out in the Urals, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very famous story in remote viewing. And the guy drew a very accurate picture of the base, okay? But you know these overhead cranes that are just like big I-beams on, you know, on big frames, you know, type of thing.
Okay.
He drew the base in this one location with big overhead crane kind of thing.
Mm.
And that looked like a big rail, okay? And the intelligence agency said, well, you messed up on that. There's no overhead crane facility there.
Right.
2 months later, there was.
So he was going in time?
Yeah, see, and that's the problem in remote viewing, because you're touching this non-corporeal bank of consciousness and knowledge. You don't have a reference in time.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give an example everybody can identify. How many times have you fallen asleep for 10 minutes or something like that? You were really tired and you were sitting in the easy chair in the living room and you dozed off for 15 minutes and you were someplace in that dream space. You were someplace for a month or something like this.
Right.
You woke up, you'd only been asleep 10 minutes.
Right. Gotcha.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I've had dreams where I was someplace for 25 or 30 years and my spouse had to tell me who I was and when I was.
Oh, boy.
You know? When you've been doing this deep meditation as long as I have, you can really, really get down very deep, and there are times, about once a month, my spouse has to tell me who I am and when I am.
So have you gone into the future?
Yeah, I've done that lots of times.
Now, what happens in our future?
It's awfully fluid.
What does that mean?
Okay, give an example.
A lot of water now?
No.
Now that the ice caps have melted?
That's coming. Trust me, that's coming.
I bet you.
Fluidity is this. You do something, it can change what's happening.
Right.
You know, I tell people,
right.
I get friends of mine, I don't do tarot cards professionally, but sometimes I'll do them for like a kid's hospital or something like that for mm-hmm. charity, raise money for charity or something like that. But I tell people, when you walk out of here, what I told you for those handful of little future cards may change 10 minutes from now because you're going to be different and you're going to change your own future.
Right.
Okay. So in the context of future, a long time ago, my perception window when I was a kid was about 3 to 4 months. Okay. As an adult, my typical perception window is about 24 to 36 months, typically about 24 months.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When I was in Vietnam and I was in a situation where I did not think I was going to live through it,
mm.
when I got to sleep, I ended up seeing myself in a wedding ceremony in a church, and there was something very distinctive about the church, okay, that is, most churches don't have this distinctiveness.
Mm.
And 27 months later, that's exactly how it played out.
Great.
But when I had that dream in Vietnam, that told me I was going to survive it.
Very good, yeah.
Okay.
And you accepted that. You accepted that.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I did. Okay, well, I'll give you another example. In 1994, I had this very horrific dream, and I was walking around the streets of Northern Virginia looking down into D.C., and I was watching people walk up 495 going south, and rows and rows of people, no traffic, no cars, just people walking down 495 heading south towards the suburbs.
Million man march?
No. 9/11.
Oh my.
Everybody, they couldn't drive the cars out, so the people left work and they just started walking home.
Gotcha.
Okay, and for some it was a 10 or 15 mile walk, you know.
I thought you said it was Washington, D.C.
It was Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay.
They're walking on 495 south.
Gotcha.
Heading towards Richmond.
I'm thinking now Manhattan. So.
No. Washington,
okay.
D.C.
Gotcha.
But the quirky thing about it was I saw in the early part of the dream two plumes down near the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I told somebody who had a connection into a intelligence community raw database, and in dreams I had months and years later, that turned into one plume.
Okay.
Okay, there wasn't, something changed, okay? Also, in the dream, they got something at the Pentagon, they got something at the White House. After I told this guy with the intelligence service this for their raw database, that White House one went away, and that second plume at the Pentagon went away.
Hmm.
Okay, so but the problem is, it was outside of my normal prediction. It was such a horrendous event. I saw it in 94-95 time frame. It didn't happen until 2011 or 2001.
Right.
Okay, and that's what I had the guy from the intelligence agency come back to me and ask me. He says, "Wait a minute, Cheryl, we know you said you have a 24 to 36 month thing and nothing like this has happened." I said, "I'm as perplexed as you are, but I'm still having the dreams." But it was, as it turned out later in analysis, it was such a horrendous deep event that the ramifications echoed back further than what my normal prediction window was.
Perhaps.
And I know other people. I was living at the time, I was physically, my household was in a Burmese monastery. And four to 6 months before 9/11,
mm-hmm.
A bunch of us were sitting having supper one night, and I said, I said, does anybody feel like something really horrendous is getting ready to go down? I mean, something is going to just literally stop everything around here for a couple of weeks. You know, and this was in the D.C. suburbs. And they all these Burmese monks looked at me and said, yeah, there's something weird going on here. I'm having horrendous dreams. People walking in the, walking down the highways, they're telling me. And I said, oh, God, I remember this. And here, that was like 6-7 years before for me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we're having this conversation, and then four or five months later, that's exactly what went down.
Is it possible that the original dream of the two plumes or in the White House, something happened where originally that plane that went down in Pennsylvania?
Yep, the United plane. I've often thought that myself. That something changed. You know?
That's what changed is that they didn't stop the flight, and
right.
then something happened to where they did.
Yeah. It's a weird phenomenon. Again, it's the future is fluid, in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about the most I can say. You know, and sometimes this kind of predictive knowledge, it's not even really predictive, it's kind of a sense of knowing, but again, you know, when you wake up in the morning and you had this really great dream and you try to tell somebody over breakfast, it was like, but it all made sense while you're in the dream, but it doesn't make sense as you're babbling across the
breakfast table.
You know, that's the problem with some of these things, because it's such deep non-verbal concepts that are being communicated to you at this deep spiritual subconscious level that there aren't necessarily words for what you're experiencing.
Right.
And that's that big problem I have with magical students, is that when we're trying to teach them to pass to retrieve information from the great consciousness or pass information to them in the form of like a magical working or something like this, it's all non-verbal, and you have to condition yourself to learn how to think in a non-verbal context when you're trying to communicate. It's a game of charades. It really is.
So how would this, or maybe not, but how could this connect with extraterrestrials / other dimensionals?
Okay. The extraterrestrials, particularly with the extraterrestrials, I know people who can close their eyes before they go to sleep in a dark room, and there's a gray sitting there, standing there looking at them.
Hmm.
Okay? I've talked to many people that have that experience, or one of the other extraterrestrials, common ones. And when you touch something far beyond that, when you're touching, you're making a connection to that bigger community, not just these like local guys that are visiting type of thing, you know, like the Greys or whoever might be hanging around locally.
Right.
When you make a bigger, deeper connection to the deeper consciousness, it's everything. I don't have words. What I've had in deep, deep meditation, I don't have words to describe. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And of course, yeah, listeners are going to say, well, I wish you would describe it. Okay, fine. Okay, let me give you a dose of it. Sentient trees singing to me.
Okay?
And I'm not the only one. I've talked to people who study with the Aborigines that have related similar stories, you know. There is consciousness out there in many, many things that doesn't look like us.
Right.
Okay. And that's what people don't understand. And as one mystic put it to me, you know, the great consciousness of the off-worlders didn't need to come here in tin cans, did they?
Yeah.
Okay. So the tin cans, you know, I have a lot of people tell me, oh, but we want to get that spaceship, and we want to crawl in the cockpit and see what it looks like, you know? And I said, you know, you might be waiting a really long time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I can introduce you to a dozen experiencers that have had very, very, very wonderful conversations and relationships with the off-worlders.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to use the term ET. I really don't.
Right.
I use the term off-worlders because some of the off-worlders are not... You know how there's the theory that some of this stuff is more local to us and not get from galaxies far, far away, but
right.
like our own subspace, local subspace?
Right.
There's a lot of that.
When you say local subspace, are you talking about other dimensions that are right
other
here?
Other dimensions in this regional space. Yeah,
right, okay,
where
gotcha.
Our planet is, and there's subdimensions.
Gotcha.
There's a great deal of that.
Right.
There's a great deal of that.
The seen and unseen worlds.
Say that again?
The seen and unseen worlds.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. As Paul would say in the Bible.
Yes. Yes, a great deal. You know, there's stuff like in Celtic tradition where they talk about the underworlds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, yeah, they're real. They really are. You know,
right, right.
And that's what people don't get. So, because most people only believe what they can see and feel with their fingers
right.
and their
right.
eyes and everything like this. And talk to anybody clairvoyant, and they're aware of a much bigger crowd of people in the room when you walk into an empty room, you
right,
know?
Right, right. Yeah. Matt Frazier.
Yeah.
Okay. And my brain just turned on again.
Yep.
Matt Frazier is one of them. I was on a cruise with him for a week. Yeah, he's amazing. But at any rate, he says he walks into a room and there's just a ton of people in there.
Well, you know, my wife won't take me to... I don't go to cemetery burials
mm-hmm.
unless I'm a parish priestess, so I in my tradition. So occasionally I have to do a committal ceremony, but very mm-hmm. rarely. But you go into an extremely large... And I'm going to say it this way, modern cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
I explain it to people like, imagine going in, you're getting ready to go in and see a concert. There's a whole bunch of chatter as you're walking in. The house is mostly full. They haven't started playing the music yet, and everybody's
right.
chattering and everything like that. Mm. That, at a psychic level, mm. that's what it feels like.
Okay, now... You're one that I could ask this question to.
Sure.
It would seem to me, just my layman brain here, that when spirit leaves the body, why are they hanging around cemeteries? They don't have that. That's where their remains, their physical remains are. Why do people go into cemeteries to do the ghost hunting and what have you?
Not everybody hangs around a cemetery.
That's what I'm thinking.
Why
would they? Why would a spirit hang around?
Remember how people have been conditioned in our culture.
Okay.
I have a poster here at the house.
Mm.
Okay. I have a big, it's a big, lovely artistic rendering of the Egyptian god Anubis. He's the great embalmer. He's the guy who weighs your heart when you fast and
okay.
whether or not you had a viable life, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the poster, we put lettering on the bottom. You were expecting Saint Peter? Okay.
Yeah.
Some of our Western culture convinces you you're supposed to, this is what it's supposed to happen to you when you die.
Mm.
And people are sitting here, what was supposed to happen next, you know?
Mm.
Again, some people hit that tunnel and go, you know, off into the light, and other people fight it and don't go, and then they're left hanging around. Now, there's another aspect to it. In Buddhism, what we were taught, and I've been taught the death rites. I'm a death and dying nun, okay?
Mm.
And we take you through a shutdown process. In West, they let you sit there in a hospital bed and draw your last breath, and everybody's wailing and crying around you. No, we don't allow that. We set the person up in bed. They're not laying prone. You set them up in bed with pillows, as erect as you can get them in the bed.
Mm.
And then, you know, you wouldn't turn off a Windows computer by just pulling the plug,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay. No, well, we take the Tibetan process of dying, we take that much more seriously, and we say, okay, fine, let's take you into your final meditation and literally talk you to death.
Okay?
Mm-hmm. And I've done it many times. I'm trained in the Poa rites. And you talk them down. In fact, a lot of my best friends, you know, they'll call me up and say, I need you to pray for my mother. She's sick in the hospital. She had a stroke last night. I said, honey, you know, if I pray for them, they're going to be dead by midnight. And they say, that's why I'm calling you.
Ah.
Okay? Not that I'm killing them, but yeah. In most cases, what the deal is...
Letting them go.
you're helping them pass.
Yeah, letting them go.
It's a shutdown process. It's taking them into their final meditation and making this a smooth transition for them to move their consciousness where it should be going instead of hanging around. Now, the other aspect is people hanging around cemeteries, people haunting houses.
Mm-hmm.
It's an effect we call the hungry ghost effect. Somebody is so attached to something in their house, their possessions, the house itself, whatever, mm-hmm. and they won't let go.
Right.
Okay, and those people, you have to pity them. They might be there hundreds of years. They might be there thousands of years. You don't know until they let it, especially if they had a horrendous passing. They got murdered there or something like
mm-hmm.
And that's the deal.
So those things that they possess now possess them.
Yeah. We call them hungry. So we have special prayers for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Now, so let's go back to E.T. a minute.
Okay. We're running out of time, but...
I'll make this real short. I know people who are... I have met people in my life who are genuine E.T. whisperers.
Mm-hmm.
They can go out there and sit down on a patio, close their eyes, go into a meditative state, and son of a gun, these things, these UFOs start showing up in a clear blue sky.
I've heard of that, too, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And a couple of them that I knew were Buddhist lamas. They seemed to be able to just call them in.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Is that a good thing or bad?
Oh, that's a good thing. It means at least one guy, the guy who called them in, has a connection to them.
Yeah.
And that's another way of them acknowledging the fact, hey, stupid earthlings, wake up, quiet your mind, we're here. You know?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, that's what it really amounts to.
All right. Well, I'm glad we got off on this subject. At the same time, there are so many questions I did not ask you that, you know, I had them all lined up here. So we're going to have to do this another time. What do you think?
Dave, that I can do for you. Now, you're going to hear some news out there in social media that I've gone on UFO hiatus.
Hmm.
Okay? And yes, I'm sort of on a vacation from UFOs, except for the two or three conferences that I'm under contract for this year. I got a little bit burned out. And in October, I had some 6,000 attacks on my computer.
Oh, good.
My daily average is about 10, which we had about 300 a month, and that's about normal baseline. Mm. I had close to 6,000 in 1 month, and something got through, turned off the fan on my computer, and it fried my motherboard.
What's wrong with people anyway?
I don't know, but there's a bunch of UFO... researchers in upstate New York that we have been attacked mercilessly in the last couple months.
Right.
It's been horrible. So I've taken a hiatus until my next book comes out, except for an interview or two that most people aren't going to hear from me for a while.
Well, I'll get back with you. We'll work something out.
And I'll talk to you anytime, Dave. No problem.
I appreciate that. And is there any upcoming events that people should be aware of?
Yes. Okay. Two. One, I'm going to be speaking at Contact in the Desert. I'm mm-hmm. doing a statistics talk, and I'll be doing a sort of a consciousness mechanism, a consciousness functionality workshop, and you'd have to look up Contact in the Desert, but the new conference just got advertised, and it's going to be about the end of March, and I'll be speaking there. My spouse and I, Linda Miller Cross, and I are sponsoring the first Upstate New York conference in Homer, New York, in September. It's a one-day conference, but it's like an all-day conference in a theater style setting. I have like four or five New York State researchers, and that should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, sounds like it. So I hope any of our listeners that are out that way will go see you, or at least get out that way and go see you. So, Cheryl Koss, I really appreciate you joining us.
Anytime, Dave, anytime.
Okay. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at WHFR.FM's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage, then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is UFOImplications.com. So please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves for the best in alternative programming. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us the first Tuesday of each month at 12 noon, when we will again be exploring the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
And dolls, you were at the malt shop with Daddy G, and we're going back to the 50s and the 60s. So hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and head on down to the malt shop where the jukebox is playing, and the kids are dancing, and here we are, back in the 50s.